coming up in the My Ag Life Daily News Report, we have the drought update from the State Water Resources Control Board meeting. That's coming up in segment 3 and 4 today. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start the show today with Taylor Chalstrom and today's Tech Thursday feature.
Hi, welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today is Tech Thursday, a bi-weekly segment where we cover technological advances in ag. Our guest today is Chris Logie, Director of Product at Semios, and we'll be discussing automated trapping for monitoring navel orangeworm in nut crops. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Taylor.
Yeah, great to have you here. Chris, researchers at Semios developed a fully networked automated trap to help for navel orangeworm monitoring and mating disruption. How and why was this tool developed?
We first developed the automated traps to better understand the phenology of the target insect we were treating with mating disruption. A camera trap provides a much more accurate view of navel orangeworm flight beginnings and endings, along with the associated population density. This, combined with our in-climate canopy monitoring, enables our innovation of variable rate mating disruption, which allows us to maximize pheromone release at the height of insect vulnerability or crop risk. It's been so successful for us so far. We have over 10,000 traps deployed in California, as well as elsewhere in the US and other countries. So it's a very proven technology.
Okay. Yeah, that's quite a lot of traps. I'm curious, Chris, how does this automated trapping platform work for those growers that have it? You know, what information is provided to them and how is it delivered?
Yeah, good. Our platform is probably equally valuable to both the grower and their PCA when it comes to camera traps. Each trap takes a picture and then it uploads it to the cloud once per day via our wireless network. The images are analyzed by AI, and if there are catches, they're also validated by an entomologist. Each day, the count summaries and photos are updated to the Semios Pest Management Dashboard, which the grower and PCA can access from their computer or mobile app. The dashboard is very visual and intuitive, where users can see a map of their fields showing the location of the traps and catch counts for each trap, as well as the daily photos of the individual traps, with now catches being highlighted. And finally, these daily trap cap summaries are overlaid with accurate degree day accumulations, which are coming from the in-canopy weather stations.
When you guys have done some surveys, maybe of the growers and PCAs that are using this technology, specifically your cloud platform there, do you find that they're having an easier time using the website or the app to do this?
It does depend on the user. So I'd say it's both. There is a high demand for usage of the mobile app. Often our users are on the go in the fields or in the truck. So the mobile app is a key part to enabling our users with this.
Chris, what are the benefits of an automated trapping system compared to maybe some of the traditional trapping methods for navel orangeworm?
Sure. There are several benefits to consider. First, saving time and labor. Given the size and scale of crop operations in the Central Valley, it's tough for everyone, especially PCAs or the trap checkers, to be where they need to be at the right time. So time and labor would be the first one. Second would be accuracy and timing. Instead of a once a week count, which is the traditional method, which really means you don't know when something was actually caught. So the automated trapping gets a daily count profile. This means you can see the start through to the end of the flight, which enables an earlier determination of the best time to intervene, providing more time to manage the logistics and get the application timing optimized. Finally, return on investment. If you're the grower, you can get a better return from the money spent on pest management materials because the recommendations are made with precision and more time to react. So if I'm a PCA, I get the right information at the right time to help inform the best treatment recommendations. And you mentioned before mobile app and web app. So in addition to that, we even include the ability to create and assign text and email alerts to the right person at the right time, including non-Semios users. So everyone that needs to know about an event can be informed automatically.
I actually want to go back and focus on that labor aspect for a second. Obviously, a technology like this aims to reduce a lot of that labor. Like you said, what kind of reduction are, you know, growers actually seeing in terms of labor?
It's mostly just that staff who would be checking traps are now enabled to be focused on other areas. So I don't think we have an actual number value, but it's more the time savings and just the precision of needing to be out there and checking them on a regular basis is reduced.
And Chris, how does it truly automate grower decisions around mating disruption, this trapping system?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, so the first thing that trap information enables is improving the timing of pheromone release. So the pheromone release is more related to the actual activity of the target pest. There's not much point in releasing pheromones during the day or at times when the moths aren't even active. That seems like a waste of pheromones that could be applied more strategically. If we think about almonds and when they're most vulnerable to damage, it's hull split. When you have a better sense of population dynamics on a daily basis, plus accurate degree day information that drives their development, combined with a prediction tool for when hull split will be, it becomes much easier to automate maximizing pheromone release for when the crop is most vulnerable. This just isn't possible with other trapping and mating solutions. The best part of this is that the grower and the PACA aren't actually having to worry about it, Taylor. So Semios manages all of this because we can remotely control everything via our wireless network. We can change schedules and release rates of the pheromone dispensers from anywhere. So if influences like weather or crop development change, we can dynamically react. Since every trap and dispenser reports to our network every 10 minutes, we can monitor their performance so growers aren't worrying about whether things are working. Finally, we install everything so growers aren't trying to find the labor to get the job done. They can focus their crews on more mission-critical tasks.
I'm curious with some of that weather detection there. Can you give an example of how the trap would change its activity around weather monitoring for certain events?
So the weather monitoring is there to basically track the in-field pest degree days. So as that, the trap doesn't change behavior, the trap is going to continue to behave the same way, but adding the in-orchard pest degree days and using those two combined helps with the timing of treatment for the growers.
All right, Chris, I understand that the automated trap is part of a larger automated crop management platform that you guys have for orchards. What are some of the other areas of decision-making where growers can use this management platform?
Yeah, and so we've been listening to our growers and we're kind of evolving the platform. And really, it's around the growers' frustration with having to use multiple disparate systems to run their operations. So, I mean, we do things like in-canopy chill tracking for pistachio growers or frost management tools for citrus providers. But water management is probably our most important development recently. And it's certainly top of mind for everyone this year in the Central Valley. So we provide things like ET calculations on site while also showing the local SIMS data so growers can compare and contrast. We have soil moisture probes and water application measurement tools, which we have deployed from one end of the valley to the other in every crop we manage. Recently, we launched an irrigation planning tool that helps growers and their irrigation teams incorporate all the important inputs, determine the best timing and volume of water to apply. And finally, we conduct every year, we have an extensive research program. And currently we have a large initiatives around irrigation and plant stress management, where we're exploring new sensors that are available and really the techniques for combining the information they provide to help inform watering decisions.
And that's obviously a lot of information there. Is that all going to be found in the same app / website that you were mentioning earlier?
Yeah, so it's the same apps and all the data there is in one spot. And that's really what we're hearing from the growers, right? If I'm getting my soil moisture data from one place and my weather data from another place and my watering timing or watering schedule somewhere else, there's lots of places to have to combine different pieces of information. So we're definitely one of the things we're focused on is bringing that all together into one platform and be that some of our own solutions or working with third parties to bring in existing solutions into the platform.
Definitely. That kind of leads me to my next question here. You know, Semios has invested significantly in the network for its automated platform systems. Why was that important in farms and orchards in California?
Yeah. In the early days, you know, there wasn't a wireless solution that would work in an orchard. Think of the leaves and the moisture and how that would impact wireless communications. So we developed and patented our own wireless network, and it was critical to our success. If you think about cell coverage challenges in the valley or in ag in general, and the fact that every sensor in the network would need to have its own network connection, deploying tech at scale would be really expensive. So we developed this network to first enable our variable rate mating disruption, and it quickly became obvious that any additional Semios, or as I mentioned, third-party hardware sensors we deployed would be more cost-effective if we could be used on the same network, which so far, that's the approach we've taken as we build out the network and new sensors are added. We've been testing other communication network technologies, but we expect our current solution will remain the primary tool for some time to come. It's so simple, reliable, and it's been proven to work in the most difficult areas in the valley. And finally, the network, the other piece that's, other than, the variable rate mating disruption and bringing sensors together onto one network for cost, the final piece is really it helps farmers scale. So farming operations in the valley can be large and widespread. So the technology makes it easy to support a grower's team who are looking after a ranch in, say, Shafter, another in Turlock, and another one way up in Orland. As we talked about earlier, you asked the question, everything's available for each site in one place with one platform login.
Definitely. So Chris, my last question for you here, how can growers acquire this management tool and use it in their orchards, and what support is available to them to do that?
Sure. I mean, first off, I'll start with the support question. We have a team of support specialists throughout the valley who will work directly with the grower and all the users to help them. As I mentioned earlier, we have a field services team that installs and maintains the equipment on the farm, while a tech support people remotely monitor its performance for any problems and any maintenance that might be needed. Finally, we have a team of customer support specialists, including software trainers, entomologists, and irrigation specialists, who help our customers get the maximum benefit from our system, whether that be how to interpret CAPTCHA data or even remembering how to log into the system. They are excited to help growers and their crop management teams learn about Semios.
Right. Awesome stuff coming from you, Chris. Thank you for coming on today and talking about this really interesting technology.
And thanks, Taylor, for the time. It's been great.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromayora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news brief for today from the California Farm Bureau. With farmers plowing under crops and removing trees due to water shortages, irrigation districts are trying to find supplemental supplies. Districts on the west side of the Central Valley face the prospect of receiving no water from a federal project. A gubernatorial drought declaration intends to streamline water transfers. Water district officials say transfers could play a key role this summer, but won't prevent significant agricultural losses. We have more on the drought in the next segment. As COVID restrictions ease, the nation's meat producers are in the process of once again making a big change to the meat supply chain. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
As restaurants and other parts of the food service sector begin to operate somewhat normally again,
beef supply chains have to kind of refocus.
And not just beef, but most meat products to some extent. This from USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski. Of course, we started pre-COVID with restaurants, hotels, schools open for normal business.
And then the supply chains got this big hiccup with COVID when everyone started eating at home and lost that food service business for a while. And now with restaurants reopening, the supply chains have to refocus again and ramp up to serve that food service sector.
And Mark says it wouldn't surprise him that there might be some small hiccups in that process leading to a few temporary problems for the food service sector in suddenly trying to secure the meat supplies they will need. There have already been some news reports of hotels and restaurants having to look longer and harder and pay a little more to get the meat they need. But Mark says this is likely to be a small, short-term situation. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced its plan to purchase domestic seafood products, including up to $17 million for three products, specifically from the West Coast, for food assistance programs. Now, this story comes from the Newport News Times. The timing, they say, couldn't be better, as fishermen and processors are still coping with COVID-19 pandemic disruptions to seafood markets and global supply chains. The USDA announcement also calls for buying other domestic commodities. Of the $159.4 million in funding for purchasing domestic products, up to $4 million can be used to purchase Pacific rockfish fillets, $4 million for Pacific pink shrimp, and $9 million for Pacific whiting. Other seafood items include pollock and salmon from Alaska and shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico and South Atlantic. West Coast Seafood Processors Association Executive Director Lori Steele says COVID-19 upended the domestic and global markets. The USDA purchases will help supplement and stabilize existing markets, allowing the industry to keep American fishing and processing families working through difficult times. The USDA and the public get healthy, nutritious seafood from sustainable stocks, and she says it is truly a win-win. The United Fresh Produce Association says pallet shortages are disrupting the produce supply chain. The organization says a lack of pallets is adding stress to a supply chain that is already facing significant challenges. Other supply chain issues include a lack of available trucks and shipping containers, labor challenges, and a pending shortage of resin used to make reusable containers and pallets. Expectations are that the pallet shortage will continue for months, perhaps for the balance of 2021. The shortage of lumber and wood products has increased the cost of raw lumber 200% to 300%. It makes the cost of wood pallets increase incrementally. USDA has made some changes to one of its most important reports, the monthly World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Stephanie Ho has the story.
The World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, or WASD, is one of USDA's premier monthly reports.
It helps with price discovery, it helps markets work more efficiently, and it levels the playing field in terms of information availability for everyone participating in the market.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jackanowski pointed to some of the report's most recent changes, which include replacing the term biodiesel with biofuel.
With regard to biofuels, that change is reflecting a change in the way that the data is being presented by the Energy Information Administration, specifically with regard to renewable diesel.
The changes go into effect in the May report.
We're no longer just tracking traditional biodiesel, which is known as methyl esters, but also the next generation or new generation of renewable diesel that is rapidly growing. And as that new data is becoming available from the Energy Department, we're going to be incorporating it into our balance sheet.
He says the change may seem minor, but is important.
Because it does reflect kind of a fundamental change in the nature of biodiesel production. So it's something that we want to keep track of because of the implications for the soybean, in particular soybean oil, balance sheet.
Another change involves how USDA is identifying the United Kingdom, which left the European Union on January 1st, 2021.
From our standpoint, they kind of left mid-crop year, so it created a bit of a challenge for us. You know, you can't break the UK out of all of the estimates mid-crop year.
So he adds that
until we started estimating for the new crop year, that the old estimates that previously would have been just reported as the European Union now are the current European Union plus the United Kingdom.
Meanwhile,
now going forward, starting in May, the European Union will be just the current members of the European Union, and the UK will be reported separately as its own country where applicable.
USDA also has outlined the process for making sure its WASDE numbers are accurate.
The data itself is very, you know, market sensitive, so we go to great lengths to try to avoid any kind of errors in our numbers. And that's why I'm putting these numbers together as a committee process, and we get lots of eyes on the balance sheet.
At the same time, he notes errors sometimes still do happen.
Where there is an actual number that we know was typed in incorrectly or calculated incorrectly, in those cases, it's just a very straightforward process of recognizing the error, going in and changing the balance sheet and reissuing it.
Any new version of the WASDE will be clearly marked as such, and all versions will be saved in the archive.
We want to be always as transparent as possible and owning up to and correcting the errors when they occur is, I think, also what helps to kind of, you know, establish the credibility.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A pioneer in developing fish-based production systems and products to feed malnourished populations globally is recognized for her achievements as this year's recipient of what's called the Nobel Prize of Agriculture. Rod Bain reports.
The 2021 World Food Prize laureate
is known for groundbreaking research, her critical insights and landmark innovations in developing holistic, nutrition-sensitive approaches to aquaculture and food systems.
And World Food Prize President Barbara Stinton says results of the laureate's efforts include...
In Bangladesh, the increased incomes and access to nutritious fish brought about by the laureate's work contributed to cutting chronic hunger by more than half and reducing the number of underweight children by one quarter in the last 20 years, putting the country back on track to meet its nutrition goals.
Beyond that, the laureate's research was behind development of fish-based nutrition-dense foods, which in turn increased fish consumption by mothers and their young children. This also led to the development of a processing industry that created a revenue source for women entrepreneurs. Those are among the reasons why...
The 2021 World Food Prize laureate is Dr. Shakuntala Haraksing Tilsted of Denmark and Trinidad Tobago.
Becoming the seventh woman in the history of the World Food Prize to receive what has been called the Nobel Prize of Agriculture and the first woman of Asian heritage.
I'm honored to receive this award and deeply humbled to be placed in such distinguished ranks as past laureates.
And she considers the World Food Prize Award a major acknowledgement
of the need to prioritize fish and aquatic foods in food and nutrition policies and programs at national and global levels.
Recognition of Tilstad's achievement was noted by, among others, 2009 World Food Prize laureate Gabisa Ijeda.
Leading the vanguard for transforming food systems, this year's laureate is a well-recognized champion striving to end poverty and malnutrition across the globe. She is an exceptional selection.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Dr. Tilstead has done groundbreaking research into small fish species that are rich in vital nutrients and minerals.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Now, she studied how smallholder farmers can grow fish, rice, sweet potatoes, and other vegetables, leading to millions of people now relying on rice field fisheries for their livelihoods, income, and food.
Dr. Tilstad will receive the World Food Prize during formal ceremonies in October, part of the annual World Food Prize event at Norman Borlaug Dialogue. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news brief for today. We'll be right back with more of today's top issues.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The State Water Resources Control Board met this week and had an update on the state's drought situation. We monitored the meeting and have the drought discussion for you now.
I want to just begin by acknowledging the obvious, very dry conditions, drought, extreme drought conditions that are already exceptional drought, as I understand it, that are creeping into the state already. There has been a lot of movement since we all discussed last 2 weeks ago when we first heard that the projects were missing about 500,000 acre feet plus of inflow that were expected, and the dire hydrologic conditions in April that really led to that. Since then, we've had an executive order that's expanded to additional watersheds in the state, including the Tulare Basin, the San Joaquin, and the Sacramento, and writ large there, the Bay Delta watershed, and including the Klamath. It has been an intense couple of weeks as we've all tried to figure out what it is that we have insofar as now a system for with the operators, but also how do we balance out what are incredibly limited supplies. I think I'll start by also saying that it's obvious that there is as much wet water in our system now than there will be certainly by the end of the summer, and may very well be going into the potential of another dry winter. And so what we're really needing to do, and what has been the focus of a lot of discussion these last 2 weeks, and I just want to acknowledge and thank Director Namath and Regional Director Conant. We have Paul Souza from Fish and Wildlife Service and also Barry Tom, and just thank them for joining us today to talk about the incredible and intense coordination that has been going on between our agencies these last weeks as we contemplate and understand not just temporary urgency change petitions, but curtailments and their impact on the system, salinity barriers that have been proposed by the drought by the project operators, and then also contributions that all of us in this system, particularly those contractors within the system, are needing to respond to. There was a lot of assumptions prior to April 1st in the way that this system was going to be operated, and this huge hole, which represents about enough water for a million Californians for a year, is the crisis that we are trying to navigate through. And we all, in our agency's capacities, are here to do our part and to balance. Certainly it's called upon the board to balance these many needs, but it's actually within the water code and it's upon us all. And we know that the operators operate a system that, again, itself requires balance amongst numerous state and federal laws amongst us. So I just want to thank everyone. I know that there's a lot of concern, I'm sure, and I've heard a lot of sort of discussion on the outside of this decision-making space between the state and the federal government, but just really appreciate everyone's patience and the opportunity here to hear from the project operators, hear from our biological fish agencies, and to discuss how it is that we're comprehensively seeing what are an incredibly a number of impacts from incredibly and catastrophically dry conditions that, of course, aren't just impacting here in California, but we see throughout the West. You know, our models, and we'll hear more about this, really aren't just even able to account for just how dry a period we went through, and is part of our real need here to continue to be better decision makers amongst us, to be informed by the best available science and data, to make very difficult decisions in balancing between all critical needs of water within this state, and but particularly as we is concerned to the Delta, which we know has been fragile before these points, continues to be stressed during times of drought, and here we find ourselves again with this balancing act I think many of us are familiar with in our professional careers, if not directly in working with some of the agencies you see before us. We're also joined by Chuck Bonham, our Director of Fish and Wildlife. I want to note, I don't see him on camera yet, but I know he will be here with us and joins what is an incredible group of leadership here on the state and federal side. So with that, just introductory quick comments, I just want to thank everyone again. And I'll hand it over to Diane Riddle from our Division of Water Rights, and who has been a real critical asset in this space too, to just go over just where we are. Insofar as I believe just yesterday we received temporary urgency change petitions. We're not in the prepared to go in detail into those because we just received it yesterday and in the middle of public noticing around them. But we want to be able to provide, again, a space here for us all to understand and consider the decisions before us. Nothing will be decided today before the board. And again, this is all an attempt to make sure that we collectively as a state and as leaders here amongst us, understanding the space and decision-making we're called to have.
We continue with the drought discussion right after this.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
We go back now to the State Water Resources Control Board meeting and the discussion on the state's water situation.
So with that, Diane, if you don't mind, maybe kind of providing some context for us here and you know, kind of how it is we find ourselves and what is the timeline, more importantly, that the public can expect around some of the decision-making points that we'll explore today but won't be deciding.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the introduction. Again, I'm Diane Riddle. I'm one of the Assistant Deputy Directors in the Division of Water Rights, overseeing the Division's Bay Delta Hearings and Special Projects Program. I'll provide some updates on some of the activities that are going on in the Division to address the drought conditions. And then I'll turn it over to DWR and Reclamation, who I think are going to elaborate on some of those activities and the dry hydrologic conditions. The first activity that I'm going to provide an update on is that the Division has been working on, you know, starting earlier in the year when we got indications that we may be facing serious dry conditions this year. The board started working on methodologies to look at water supplies and demands within the Bay Delta watershed to determine if there were instances in which there was not adequate supply to serve water users at their priority of right. We've been working very hard on that effort. Staff has done a phenomenal job pulling all of the pieces together very quickly. We dusted off the methodology that we used in the prior drought, made a lot of improvements to that methodology, and we released a draft methodology for looking at water supply and availability in the Bay Delta watershed last Tuesday for public review and comment. We are planning to have a workshop on that methodology on Friday. Then written public comments on the methodology would be due on May 25th. And we have an informational item before the board to provide an update on where the methodology stands based on the public comments we've received. And what we're thinking about in terms of issuing notices of water unavailability to water users in the Bay Delta watershed. Based on current estimates, it's looking like water may be unavailable for all post-1914 users in the Bay Delta watershed as early as June. Again, we're going to refine the estimates. We had anticipated maybe taking a little more time to do that, but given the very dire hydrologic conditions, I think a lot of our efforts are being expedited right now, and we're really looking for input from the public on critical assumptions related to the methodology that warrant updating before we look at issuing potential notices during the June time period. As Chair Esquivel indicated, the governor issued an emergency drought proclamation that provides additional authority for the board to potentially consider emergency regulations. We'll be looking at that, determining whether that may be needed or not. also looking in the future if there may be instances in which water appears to be unavailable for pre-1914 and riparian users. But the first step in the process is a workshop on Friday, hearing from the public on their thoughts of critical updates to the methodology that should be made before the board proceeds with using that methodology. Then, as Chair Esquivel indicated, we did receive a temporary urgency change petition from DWR and Reclamation yesterday requesting modifications to June and July delta outflow requirements, as well as the agricultural salinity requirements on the Sacramento River from June through August. We are currently assessing that temporary urgency change petition. We are planning to issue a notice for the petition as early as today or tomorrow. Given the expedited nature of everything that's occurring right now, we're anticipating a quick turnaround on public comments. Pursuant to the provisions related to temporary urgency change petitions, the board may act on the petition prior to receipt of public comments. That may be necessary given the need for the change starting in June in order to help with some of the water supply shortages that currently exist, providing for some of this water to be backed up into storage for critical needs extending over the water year. So we're anticipating that we would likely take action on the temporary urgency change petition around the time that public comments would be due at the beginning of June. After we take action on the temporary urgency change petition, we can make modifications to the order based on public comments. And so that's still a part of the process. The other activity that the division is working on is on Friday, DWR submitted a application for a 401 water quality certification for installation of temporary rock barrier at Falls River and another measure to help with salinity conditions to allow the projects to retain more water in storage to meter out over the season to address the critically dry conditions. We issued a notice on the 401 water quality certification on May 17th, and we're anticipating taking action on the 401 water quality certification in early June.
That is our show for today. Thank you so much for those of you who have emailed me about our drought coverage and more. And if you'd like to suggest topics for us to watch, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.